Today's show is brought to you by Underbrush, a new thriller by Kevin Carr. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. We've got five new movies to talk about this week, even though there's really only one opening wide. We've got The Longest Ride, and because we don't want to just talk about that awful movie, we're going to be talking about While We're Young, expanding into theaters this week, Kill Me Three Times, which is opening this week, Cut Bank, which is also expanding, and Merchants of Doubt, which is finally coming to my neck of the woods, so I figured I'd cover it on the show this week. There's also going to be news, the trailer park, some box office predictions, and of course the world famous DVD roundup. But first, this is how you can get in touch with me. If you want to email me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. To find me on the internet, you can go to fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies, or you can go to twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That's right, Ron Burgundy. Here we go into the news. There's some weird development stuff happening this week. The first one is, and this isn't exactly movies, it's more TV because it's Showtime, David Lynch has dropped out of the Twin Peaks revival, which has caused quite a stir because, according to Lynch, he kind of publicly walked out and took his ball and went home and stated there wasn't enough money in the budget to do really what he wanted to do. And so he left the show. And, of course, that sends everybody up in arms, not just fans, but the original cast. You had this whole video online with people like Machen Amick and Sherilyn Fenn and all the other people who had starred in Twin Peaks and were expected to come back for this one. Kind of, well, what would happen if we didn't have David Lynch? And I think that's an important thing to point out, because even though he only directed a handful of episodes, it was his baby. And even though David Lynch is a weird dude, his stuff worked in the show running aspect of the show. And having anybody else take control of that seems a little bit odd, or a little bit crass even at this point. We'll see if he comes back. Showtime wants him back, of course, and a lot of the actors and people involved in it don't want to come back without him. This thing needs to have David Lynch if it's going to be authentic Twin Peaks. The next piece of news is Star Wars episodes 1-6 have been released on digital HD. They just got released this week on Friday, and now anybody can download or stream. Now, I don't know why this made such a big story, because it's been available on Blu-ray for years. It's been available on DVD for over a decade. Yeah, the portability of it, you can actually stream it and save it on different devices, that's available. But here's why. Look, unless you're like diehard wanting to save the movie on and watch it on your iPad and watch it on an airplane, or keep it on your cloud, you've already got it. Now, there was a big rumor, which is just my own industry being a snake eating its tail, thinking, oh, is this going to be on shot first? There was this rumor that that was going to happen, and all it was just to get people to click on their stories. Internet writing has gotten so bad, even in the industry that I work, it's indecipherable from other tabloid writing, because all it's done is it exists just to get clicks and just to get comments. And here's the thing. It was never going to be the original releases in this streaming release. Disney's holding that back. Disney will release theatrical versions. I don't know when, but it's going to be happening in the next year or two. I'm sure there's going to be an announcement, because they want to build off of the Star Wars The Force Awakens buzz. But it wasn't going to happen on this one, and they weren't going to change one stupid little thing. And the fact that the Star Wars movies are unaltered from the last time it was released is a step in the right direction, because what had happened was, when they went on Blu-ray, Lucas made a couple more changes to them, and that just was making people more mad. They'll eventually get the theatricals out there. Quit bellyaching, people. All the people that are really bellyaching about it are like the young hipsters and old farts like me. Well, the old farts, you've seen it already, so what are you complaining about? And the young hipsters, you're in your 20s. You'll get to see it eventually. Another piece of news, Doctor Who has been confirmed to continue until at least 2020, which seems really far, but that's really only 5 years away. 2020 was an insurmountable year when I was a kid. That's only 5 years away. So Stephen Moffat thinks it's going to go at least 10 more years, but they're guaranteed for 5 more years, which is great. And that's probably going to at least be the run of Peter Capaldi as Doctor. There's also, in development news, Five Nights at Freddy's, the video game, is getting an adaptation, which I've never played it. My kids play it on their iPods or Kindles or whatever. And I know it's extremely popular. It makes more sense than Minecraft to me, but it's just very early in the development of that one. Another piece of remake news is a remake of She's All That is in the works. It's going to be produced by Spike Lee's wife, Tanya Lewis Lee. And what's hilarious about this is if you go and read the comment sections from people, it's blowing up for people who grew up in the 90s. Because like, no, that's a great movie. Why'd they have to remake that? Hey, guys, newsflash. She's All That was an adaptation of My Fair Lady, which was an adaptation of Pygmalion. This is not an original story. It'd be like saying, oh my God, they're remaking 10 Things I Hate About You. Well, guess what? That was based on a Shakespeare play. They're remaking Romeo and Juliet. It's what's so stupid about young people today. They don't even realize the stuff they think is original isn't original anymore. I've told this story. I was once talking to a girl in high school at a screening because she was friends with this guy I knew at the screening. And we were talking. Somehow we got on the subject of Romeo and Juliet. And she goes, well, I like the original one. I'm like, you mean the Shakespeare one? The one that came out hundreds of years ago in the play? No, the one with Claire Danes and Leonardo DiCaprio. And I'm like, okay, first of all, that's not the original anything. For Romeo and Juliet. No, you mean the Olivia Hussey one? No. The one that came out less than 20 years ago. Everything's a remake. And She's All That. Now, I'm not saying that that's going to be a good movie, but the fact that people are losing their minds over the fact that they're remaking She's All That, forgetting the fact that it in itself is a remake of sorts. And then finally, Need for Speed is getting a sequel. Remember that movie from last year that didn't make any money? Well, it's a racing movie, and because Fast and Furious has made an obscene amount of money, they're saying, well, let's get a Need for Speed movie, because it's basically Fast and Furious. It's not. Ultimately, Need for Speed is getting made with Chinese money, so expect it to take place in China and have a Chinese cast that they're really trying to pump up there, but they're also going to get American people involved in it, which is essentially what they did with Age of Extinction, the Transformers 4, because they said, let's shoot it in China, let's make it take place in China. And the Americans were bored with the series. It did okay in America, but it did great guns in China because the Chinese audience, two things. First of all, they're like, oh, look, it's in China, so we can recognize that. And that drives our egos. But also, you don't need to listen to the dialogue or read the subtitles to understand what's going on in Transformers. There's no plot. It makes no sense in any language. And that's the way Need for Speed Part 2 is going to be. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the trailer park. We actually played a trailer for this a couple months ago. Tomorrowland opens next month, May 22nd. We finally got a full trailer for it.
We've been looking for someone like you for a very long time. The future is running out. You have to come with us to change it.
Why me?
He thinks you can fix the future. You wanted to see Tomorrowland. Here it comes.
This thing just looks fantastic. And it's Brad Bird. I wasn't a wild fan of Ratatouille, but I love The Incredibles. And I thought Iron Giant was really cool. And Ghost Protocol was really awesome. I'm really looking forward to seeing what he's done. This just looks fascinating. Of course, you didn't see any of it because this is the radio. But you can hear there's a little bit more to it than just the tease that they've got. But they're still not giving too much away. And it comes out like in 6 weeks. Which is fantastic that they're not ruining a movie with all of the spoilers that they tend to put into a trailer. The next trailer I want to talk about is Straight Outta Compton, which is, of course, the biopic of NWA, which includes like Dr. Dre and Ice Cube. It opens on August 13th.
You had the chance to change the situation. Would you take it?
You're listening to Compton's very own Ice Cube, Eazy-E, and Dr. Dre. I gotta tell you, you are witnessing history.
People are scared of you guys.
You have a unique voice. The world needs to hear it.
They want NWA? Let's give them NWA.
You want to hear what I have to say about this, because I am the voice of urban America. Look at me and you say, that guy is hip, he's with it, he knows everything about being ghetto. This looks like an interesting enough movie. I'm not a big fan of rap music or hip hop at all, really, but sort of like Notorious, when they did the movie on Notorious B.I.G., this one could be an interesting story of just sort of like what happened behind the scenes. All right, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Longest Ride and Cut Bank. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies coming at you. Let's talk about a couple movies now. We've got five of them to talk about. Let's go top down with the first one, which is opening wide this week, and that is The Longest Ride. A bull rider who's been injured tries to get back in the game, falls in love with a college girl, and they befriend an old man whose past relationship mirrors their own. Then probably somebody dies, just like every other freaking Nicholas Sparks movie out there.
I just came to drop this off.
Where'd you get that?
From your car?
I haven't been able to read these for years.
You want me to read them to you? April 10th, 1940. Is that the kind of way to face the burning heat? My dearest Ruth, I'll remember that dress you wore even when I've forgotten my own name.
I wish I could tell you it'll all be happily ever after. Not everybody gets that.
Before I get accused of dropping spoilers in my intros, I wrote that intro before I saw the movie. Why? I do that with every Nicholas Sparks movie, because his movies are shamelessly formulaic. I mean, talk about paint by numbers. You can just take all the elements and shuffle them together. I should do that. I should write down all the elements for a Nicholas Sparks movie and then shuffle them together to predict what the next Nicholas Sparks movie is about. This movie's terrible. It is awful. It is nonsensical. Nicholas Sparks, I think, is losing his mind. He has so swirled around his own formula, swirling the toilet bowl of his own formula, to the point that he's getting confused in making his movies. If you remember, the last movie he did was The Best of Me, which thank God did not do well. In fact, The Best of Me did actually kind of miserably. It was not a popular film, but it had the same thing. The wealthy girl, the not so wealthy boy, they are sort of star-crossed impossible lovers, and then their passion ignites and it transcends decades. Now, in The Best of Me, here he is reusing his own tropes from literally the previous movie. In The Best of Me, their relationship in present day was mirroring their relationship when they were younger. It's Scott Eastwood and Britt Robertson playing the characters. Scott Eastwood is Clint Eastwood's son. He's only 29, so Clint Eastwood was, you know, he was making babies late into his life. I mean, to show how old Clint Eastwood is, he was older than I am now, and I'm an old fart. He was older than I am now when he had Scott. And there, the most buzz about this is how much Scott Eastwood looks like Clint Eastwood. He really does. He looks a lot like a young Clint Eastwood. But that's where the interest in this movie ends. Because, of course, their characters are following the story of Alan Alda's character, who's this old guy, who honestly, when you start doing the math, the guy must be in his 90s, who they find him crashed, and they get him to the hospital, and they find these letters. It makes no sense, because then they start reading these love letters that Alan Alda's character had written to his wife, but the letters are recounting how they met. And I'm like, why is he writing to his wife, explaining to her how they met, and explaining to her very key points? I mean, these weren't typical love letters. You know, I mean, I remember when I was a kid, everyone writes love letters, that kind of thing. I mean, I don't know. Like, now they just send texts and pictures of their junk. But I remember when I was younger, I worked for a summer physically far from where my wife lived, or at the time, my girlfriend, and we wrote letters to each other. Every now and then we find them, and they're stupid and they're gooey. But I don't sit there and I don't recount to her things that we both experience. It doesn't make any sense. And the movie itself, there's scenes where the continuity is so off and bizarre, and characters are doing things that I honestly thought they had edited out moments of the movie. Thank God they didn't keep him in there because it was already over 2 hours anyways. But the movie makes no sense. And the story is supposed to be about this guy who's a bull rider and his girlfriend who's an art student and their passionate love. The problem is then they keep breaking off and telling the story of Ira, who's Alan Alda's character, and his love life. And they go off these 20-minute diversions where they finally get back to Scott Eastwood's character, which already the men in the Nicholas Sparks movies are so underdeveloped, as are the women, but the men are so underdeveloped, they are just there to look pretty. I mean, they're like porno story characters. They just are there to look pretty and be chivalrous and to be a little bit troubled either by a abusive father or a dead father, because in this movie his father's dead, or he's struggling with something, but there's no depth whatsoever to him, and there's very little depth to the woman, too. These are absolute crap. This is awful, awful filmmaking, awful, awful writing, and then it's nonsensical. Like, there's a scene, they find him crashed into this tree, and they get him out, and they have his letters, and then they take him to the hospital, and the woman stays with him, and she sends Scott Eastwood home. And she stays with, and so she has this box of letters, and she's kind of flipping through them in the emergency room, and they're like, oh, he's awake, you can come see him now. And she comes down, and the nurses, they're bugging him to eat. I'm like, wait a minute, he just got here like a couple hours ago. I've seen people in the hospital. They're not forcing you to eat dinner at 3 a.m. because you just woke up from a coma or something. It doesn't make sense. This movie, it's nonsensical. It's terrible. It's as dumb and as stupid as The Best of Me. This is a terrible movie. They did not screen it for me. I am not surprised. It is crap. Do not see this movie. It sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Cut Bank, which is a smaller film, kind of coming under the radar. It's released by A24, which has done some innovative stuff, particularly last year. They had a great slate. This year, we're going to see how their slate is working out. In Cut Back, a former high school football star in a small town hatches a plan to move away, but he is met with disastrous consequences.
Wait, no, no. Parcel.
Wayne heard they murdered the mailman.
Where's the mail?
They kidnapped him.
So we got ourselves a video of a murder. First murder this town has ever seen.
So you're really getting all that money? How much?
A lifetime sum.
All I need is to see the mailman's dead body. We are set.
The biggest problem with this movie is it stars Liam Hemsworth, who's about one of the most boring guys on camera ever. I've never seen a movie with Liam Hemsworth in it that makes it interesting. But aside from all that, it's got a great cast. I mean, it's got Bruce Dern in there. It's got John Malkovich. It's got Billy Bob Thornton. It's got Oliver Platt. It's got Teresa Palmer. She does a great doughy-eyed, stupid Midwestern girl whose pinnacle of her life is trying to go out for a beauty pageant. A lot of people compare this film to Fargo because there's murder and revenge and off-kilter characters and weird people, and it takes place in the northern central United States, which I've been to. I mean, I don't think I've ever been to Cut Bank, but I've been up in the middle of nowhere in Montana. And it's not trying too hard to be Fargo. That's the thing. It's not trying to do the weirdness that the Coen brothers did with Fargo. It's much darker. And as dark as Fargo was, it's like, imagine the one character, the Swede in Fargo, played by Peter Stormare. Imagine the entire movie's populated with those people. And it's not funny. And that's what makes it cool. Now, there's also a fantastic performance by Michael Stuhlbarg. And if you don't know who he is, you probably don't. He was in A Serious Man, which was one of the Coen brothers' films, about a Jewish man in the 60s who was just having all this crap happen to him and have to deal with it. He is fantastic in this movie, and I didn't even recognize him. And where he goes with this and his performance is pretty amazing. It keeps you guessing, and it keeps spinning around. Now, one of the things that also makes it feel similar to Fargo isn't even about the movie. It's got Billy Bob Thornton, and it's got Oliver Platt in it, both of whom were in the Fargo TV show. And just their appearance feels Fargo-ish in a way. Yeah, it marginalizes middle-of-nowhere, small-town America, maybe a little bit more than it needs to. And it's a bit odd having two Australians in the lead, Liam Hemsworth and Teresa Palmer. But it's an interesting movie. It's different and it's got some great performances. I got to say, check it out because Cut Bank kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
With that, I need to go to a break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking about While We Are Young and Kill Me Three Times. Gar with Fat Guys at the Movies, coming back for two more movie reviews. Let's talk about While We're Young. Ben Stiller and Naomi Watts stars a couple in their 40s who befriend a couple in their 20s and struggle to keep up with their erratic lifestyle.
I really loved your film. It was that scene with the dogs around the garbage. How did you stage that?
I said, hey, shoot those dogs.
Beautiful. You want to come get a bite with us?
Why do you suddenly want to hang out with a couple of 25-year-olds?
We were just 25. I mean, we weren't, but, you know, it'll be fun.
We met this interesting couple.
What's the rumpus, Rednecks?
I like how engaged they are in everything.
It's like their apartment is full of everything we once threw out, but it looks so good the way they have it. Being around them energizes you.
It's infectious.
This is directed by Noah Baumbach, and there's a lot of people who have no idea who that is, and I recognize that. He hasn't done a Marvel movie. He's not well known outside of independent circles. He's closer to like a Woody Allen, like a modern Woody Allen. And I know that's going to turn off a lot of people in the mainstream, because there's a lot of people in the mainstream who don't like Woody Allen. And I imagine there's a lot of people in the mainstream who aren't going to be interested in Noah Baumbach. He's done movies like The Squid and the Whale. He did Greenberg. He did Francis Ha a couple years ago. And what's interesting about Francis Ha and Greenberg in particular is those had Greta Gerwig starring in them. And I love Greta Gerwig. She's kind of this indie darling, and she's sweet and very warm and affectionate on screen, and she kind of connects to the viewer through the lens. She's a great indie actress. And they, of course, had a relationship because, like most directors in Hollywood, they can't keep it in their pants. And when they got a younger, attractive, blonde muse, they want to have sex with her. And so then they end up making a couple movies with her. You know, this is the Woody Allen thing. I mean, Woody Allen did it with Diane Keaton, and he did it with Mia Farrow. I mean, yeah, I'm surprised Suni's not in any of his movies nowadays. But going back to Noah Baumbach, when he was, I don't know how old Noah Baumbach is, but he's not in his 20s. He's probably at least my age. He's probably in his 40s. But Greta Gerwig, when he met her and started having sex with her and you know, using that the director, actors, I find that just crass. I don't care who you are. Just as an aside, I've known people in independent film who really are just in there to bang actresses. And I understand it happens, but it's like going to a college and there's this professor who's banging a co-ed. I'm sorry, that's just crass. I'm sorry. I mean, we all have the fantasy, but come on, people, grow up. And when I went to high school, there was a girl who constantly dated older men. She dated a substitute teacher. And a lot of them, the girls are like, oh, I like dating mature men. And it's like, yeah, if you're so mature you have to date somebody that far out of your age range, there's something immature about you. That's just my little soapbox. So I think Noah Baumbach's a bit of a sleaze for basically banging his muse. Tim Burton did it. I mean, this all these directors do it. And I think it's stupid and crass and childish and immature. So with that said, I'm sure that when he was dating Greta Gerwig, he dealt with a lot of generational gaps and things that the people in their 20s were doing that he was older and wasn't quite doing. I've hung out with people in their 20s. I have no interest in my 40s to hang out with somebody in their 20s. It's basically a midlife crisis that Naomi Watts and Ben Stiller's characters are going through. And they, instead of having an affair with somebody who's younger than them, they just become friends with this couple. And it is Noah Baumbach venting his spleen about these culture gaps, but they're so weirdly specific and inaccurate. Like, there's a whole scene in there where he's talking about how they are into all this old stuff because, of course, they collect vinyl and they watch VHS tapes. They're collectors of that because, and they say, and I think it's in the trailer, they say, oh, it's like they have our whole apartment stuff we threw out. And there's a whole scene where they're showing Ben Stiller, Naomi Watts' character on their iPads and iPhones. And then they cut back to Adam Driver and Amanda Seyfried's character, and they're watching a VHS tape of The Howling, and they're listening to vinyl records. And I'm like, oh, yeah, because the kids in their 20s, they don't use tablets and smartphones at all. They are all about, yeah. You know, the thing is, the difference with this generation is the people in their 20s, it's not that they reject new stuff and embrace old stuff. They just want everything. They want to experience everything. They want vinyl records. And they want a big collection of records and a turntable, but they also want an iPod that they can listen to when they're on the go. There's a difference between when that was your only option, was vinyl, and then you upgrade into the digital world. I'm not dissing vinyl, but I'm saying this generation, he misses the mark on a lot of this stuff. And he also has this whole scene where they're trying to remember something, and they like pull out their phones just so they could Google it, and Adam Driver's like, no, let's just try to remember. It's more fun that way. And I'm like, oh, this sort of esoteric BS of Zen and the art of being 25 is so dumb at times, because I have literally watched people in their 20s just on a whim pull out their phone for any stupid reasons. The difference is they don't actually look up anything important. Nowadays, you have this access to some knowledge of human experience by going through Google and the internet almost at any time you want, and people still don't know how to spell whoa. It's W-H-O-A, by the way, not whoa, W-O-A-H. Yet this generation doesn't care. And that's fine. Every generation is stupid, and every generation is young at some point. 20 years from now, when they're older, there's going to be something else that they don't understand. So while it's an interesting enough look at what it's like to be in your 40s, trying to be friends with people in their 20s, it gets a lot of things wrong. It has some funny moments to it, and it probably holds it together better than most of Noah Baumbach's recent movies. The problem is when it comes to the story, it's this thing about he's a filmmaker, and Adam Driver is really this filmmaker who's also trying to use his connections, and that whole thing is irrelevant to the story, and that's kind of dumb. I mean, talk about getting in the way, it really gets in the way. And it's one of those movies where if it just accepted the fact that it didn't have a plot, it probably would have been better than to try and shoehorn this plot in that really doesn't make sense and doesn't serve a purpose. So ultimately, I'm going to say that While We're Young kind of rocks, but it's with a lot of reservations.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Kill Me Three Times. A hitman in Australia gets caught up in a murder plot with a dentist trying to run a scam to pay off gambling debts.
I need everything out of him within the week.
We're good for the money.
Well, we will be.
Are you seeing someone else? Because I couldn't handle something like that.
Sometimes they make it too easy.
I want you to kill my wife.
Do you have that sort of cash just laying around?
She took it.
All right, I'll do it.
I love my wife very much.
Well, you've got a crazy way of showing it.
This is not a new story, because we've seen the story of somebody who owes money to somebody else, and they have some wacky scheme that they're trying to do, and then it involves murder and him. You know, hey, we were just talking about Fargo earlier when I was talking about Cut Bank. That's essentially what happens in Fargo. The whole thing is William H. Macy's character, he owes money to somebody for some reason. He needs money, and he's trying to do all these schemes to get it, which of course then has disastrous effects. Now, in Kill Me Three Times, it's a little more direct, but it's sort of told from three different points of view, kind of. It's mainly told from the point of view of Simon Pegg's character, who's the hitman. And he's the most interesting of the bunch, and he really is the glue that holds this movie together. It shows the life of the dentist and his wife, who's played by Teresa Palmer. And then, of course, there's a guy in there, Luke Hemsworth is in there. So I watched two movies this week starring Teresa Palmer and a Hemsworth brother who's not in the Marvel movies. But, you know, you see they're behind the scenes and the way they work. And then, of course, there's this woman who is the waiter. She's the wife of a guy who owns a bar and the guy who ends up hiring the hitman to kill her. It's a twisted plot and has these twists and turns and connections. You know, it's not great, but it's actually pretty fun. It's different enough from this kind of movie. And it walks that fine line. There's a fine line to walk between a movie that's about a crime that goes disastrously wrong. And those kind of movies are always in danger of being too cool, or they try to be too ludicrous and become this bumbling comedy. And that doesn't work either. It manages to walk that line. And even like Simon Pegg's character, he's a bad dude and he is not a nice guy. But he takes it serious enough that you can actually believe this guy exists. And the people in the movie, all the characters, at least there seems to be a certain amount of grounding them in reality. And it's got a decent enough cast. It's worth seeing. It's different. It's on demand now, but it's also opening in local theaters this weekend. So you can check your local listings, or you can just go get it on demand. It's from Magnet Pictures. Definitely worth checking out. Kill Me Three Times kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break, and when I come back, I'm going to be talking about Merchants of Doubt, the box office, and the world-famous DVD Roundup.
Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys in the Movies, winding down the show. We've got one more movie to talk about because it's a big release for movies. This one actually came out officially in 2014. And in fact, I received an award screener for it. So it was in consideration for documentaries from last year. The reason I'm covering it now is because it's opening in my local market in Columbus, Ohio at the Gateway Film Center, which is a great place. By the way, if you happen to live in Columbus, Ohio or nearby Columbus, Ohio, check out the Gateway Film Center. Yeah, it's on campus, so you do have to deal with college students and some really terrible parking. But it's a great film center. They have fantastic programming. They have so many movies opening, I can't cover them all. They have expanded beyond just the two or three big releases. They've got smaller releases like Kill Me Three Times, and they've got Merchants of Doubt, which is in rock and roll release, and it's coming out now. If you want documentaries, if you want foreign films, if you want mainstream stuff, if you want more fringe stuff, like It Follows opened there, and Spring, we've talked about those all open. The Gateway Film Center is really kind of cool. They're doing some great stuff with it. But they're showing Merchants of Doubt. But in Merchants of Doubt, the misinformation tactics that were used for the smoking industry in the last century are examined against the political debate over climate change.
The tobacco companies knew nicotine was an addictive drug, yet they told Congress,
I believe nicotine is not addictive.
You see, the same small group of people that the tobacco industry used working on all kinds of other issues.
Dioxins, pesticides, chemicals in general. I mean, there's no evidence.
Catastrophic global warming is a hoax.
There's no scientific consensus.
You go up against a scientist, most of them are very hard to understand and very boring.
Before I actually talk about the movie, I'm going to just state right now, I am not here to debate climate change. I'm not here to take a side, because I don't really do politics on this show. So every now and then I swerve into politics if I really, really feel passionately about it. I try to stay out of politics. If you want to listen to politics on the radio, there are plenty of other options out there. In fact, if you're listening to this show on the radio, chances are wait an hour, or in this case, wait 10 minutes, and you will probably hear a political talk show. I'm not going to get into a debate over climate change, because that's not what this is about. And that's not really what, that's kind of part of the problem with the movie, is the movie has a fascinating perspective, because what it does is it goes back and it shows historically what the tobacco industry did and when they knew things and how long they denied it and how they not only went about denying it, but how they manipulated other things that you had no idea they were manipulating at the time, like asbestos. And the development of asbestos and the requirements to put asbestos in like furniture, and how they worked with lobbying and how they worked with dealing with Congress and dealing with the laws. Because ultimately, when it comes to like smoking, the tobacco companies don't care whether it's right or wrong. And this is the way corporations really are. In general, corporations, especially large ones, they serve a board of directors and they serve the corporate interest. They don't serve the public interest. It's not what corporations do. Corporations are structured in a way to benefit itself first and foremost, and everything else is secondary. So the tobacco industry was interested in self-preservation and making money, which is what corporations do, and that's what businesses do. And this is how they were influencing legislation. And they didn't care whether it was right or wrong, they cared about the laws. And what they do is they say, let's look at what these corporations did for tobacco and how long they drug that debate out for like 50 years of knowing that tobacco was harmful to the whole climate change thing, and saying, well, you've got some of the same key players, you've got a lot of the same tactics, people who would go on and would deny, and it was more or less cast doubt over climate change. And of course, there's a very large segment of the scientific community, enough to really say there's a consensus on climate change. But how that is then politicized and how that is then manipulated in the press to ultimately affect legislation and more or less environmental legislation. And the reason for that is most legislation that's concerned with climate change involves some sort of regulation and restricting business. And that's the big trade-off here in the marketplace. It's very interesting for the first half, and this is oftentimes what happens in the documentary. It's very interesting and profound and eye-opening in the first half, but then it tries to make its point and it steps a little bit too far into its own trap. One of the things they do, for example, is they go back to the cigarette industry and they're like, in 1980-something, there was this testimony in Congress. And then in 1994, there was this information in Congress. And I'm like, wait a minute. I've known ever since I was pretty much born that smoking was bad. Everybody knew smoking was bad in the 70s. And maybe in the 50s and 60s, you could convince people that it wasn't bad. Everyone knew in the 70s, and especially in the 80s, and certainly in the 90s, everybody knew that cigarette smoking was not healthy. But the way they paint this, it makes it like the debate started in the 90s, and it was been going on for years. They interview one guy about climate change and environmental discussion, and there's this impression that this issue also kind of started in the 80s and 90s, and it didn't. People were talking about climate change and global warming, and that's in the 70s and earlier. And the reason they don't address that is because a lot of the people there were gloom and doom, terrifying, in 30 years, the world's going to end. Well, in 1975, if you're saying in 30 years, the world's going to end, we passed 2005 10 years ago, and the world didn't end. And now you can sit there and say, well, there's significant changes and that sort of thing, and this happened, and polar ice and polar bears and all that kind of stuff. And you can point to all these things. But the point is, that didn't happen. And the biggest obstacle that climate change, global warming, and environmental advocates have is finding a sense of urgency to get people interested. Because to say somebody, well, in 100 years, this may become a real problem, nobody cares. Anytime you watch one of these videos, there's a certain point where they go into the alarmist stuff. And that's very hard to disprove because all I have to do is just wait around for 10 years. And then you can say, oh, well, this didn't happen the way they predicted. Ergo, what else is wrong? And this was one of the problems, by the way, with An Inconvenient Truth, which is Al Gore's movie, is he showed things that were not accurate. One of the things he showed, the laws of the snow on Kilimanjaro, which has nothing to do with climate change, global warming, has to do with deforestation and weather patterns in that very specific area and how the air goes up the mountain and causes the snow. In An Inconvenient Truth, he also talks about Hurricane Katrina and how that was caused by global warming, which that was not caused by global warming. It was not a high hurricane season. It just happened to hit landfall at that time and at that place, and then the levees broke. If those levees hadn't broke, Katrina would not have been a big deal. Those levees had nothing to do with global warming. The levees had to do with infrastructure of the city and just bad luck of the draw of where that hurricane actually went. What ends up happening is there is misinformation in its own thing, and then when it gets busted on that, it then becomes a bit of a problem. And they literally say, well, we're not trying to get people up into a fury and get them crazy, and then they turn right around and say, well, this may not change, and we may not be able to go back, and in 20 years, we're all going to be dead. And they don't say that specifically, but that's kind of where they end up going with this. You need to have that sober argument to really make a sober point, and they don't. And that's a problem in the film. So overall, Merchants of Doubt has some problems simply because it's got misinformation from everybody, even within that movie. And it's got manipulation of facts, and that can be a problem. So I'm going to have to say Merchants of Doubt kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's talk really quick about box office. Was I correct? I said $100 million for Furious 7. I was actually way off. It was like $147 million, which is insane. That's like, first of all, that's a record for April, but that's pushing up against the, what is it, 160 or 158 million for The Dark Knight? I mean, this is a massive record, especially for a non-3D release. This week, I think that Furious 7 is also going to win. I don't think The Longest Ride is going to be able to, even if you say Furious 7 brings in less than half, you're still looking at 60 to 70 million for Furious 7 this weekend. So that's what I think is going to win. And then The Longest Ride is going to be like 30, if that, maybe 20. I'd love to see it do less, but there are a lot of people in the show that I went to. You can't underestimate the power of a weeping woman in the movie theater. And ultimately with Furious 7, there's, of course, people that are talking about wanting to do more movies. They're talking about doing Furious 8, 9, and 10 already. They're talking about a new trilogy. I'll be curious to see what happens with the death of Paul Walker and how that affects it. And whether or not this is going to peak. Because this was a really fun action movie, but it was also Paul Walker's swan song. It was the end of his character, and they said goodbye to him. So it had that wrapped up into it. And the next movie is not going to be the quote-unquote original parts, which is what started this whole four-movie oomph with Fast and Furious, Fast 5, Fast and Furious 6, and then Furious 7. This all built to this. I don't think it's going to keep getting higher, which is what Universal wants, but I don't know if it's going to happen. And then when's this going to spin off into other movies? I am sure they're going to kill the golden goose in this somehow. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous DVD roundup. Going to burn through these really quick because we don't have a whole lot of time. The biggest movie is A Most Violent Year, which was, of course, J.C. Chandler's movie from last year. Made a little bit of a splash in award season, but ultimately kind of got lost in the shuffle. There's also The Voices with Ryan Reynolds, and then some classic Blu-ray releases of singles, Detroit Rock City, Breathless with Richard Gere, Silent Running with Bruce Dern, Imitation of Life, both versions of that film are available in the Blu-ray, and then Inside Amy Schumer, seasons 1 and 2 from Comedy Central. That's it. I need to go for the week. Next week, we're going to be talking about Paul Blart 2. Of course, that's going to win an Oscar. Monkey Kingdom, which is kind of the same as Paul Blart 2, and Unfriended. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.